Welcome to Breaking News with Ben Hunt, Jack Forehand, and Matt Ziegler. Before we start, let me remind you what the show is not. Breaking News is not a show about fact-checking. Breaking News is not a show about saying whose bias is the one and only correct bias. And Breaking News is definitely not a show about calling out fake news. Breaking News is a show where we look at today's top stories and have a conversation around our favorite critical question, why am I reading this now? Drawing on the headlines we're tracking at fiatnews.com, join us as we talk about what's collectively making us tick with clear eyes, full hearts, and this obligatory disclaimer. Nothing in this podcast is advising you to buy or sell any security or to do anything with your money. Seriously, you should only act on investment advice from someone you know and someone who knows your unique situation. We are not that person.
To Breaking News, I'm Matt Ziegler, joined as always by Say Hello, Jack Forehand.
Hello, Jack Forehand.
And say hello, Ben Hunt.
Hello, Ben Hunt.
Oh, guys, we got some fun stuff to talk through today. We're going to mix up the big story in the zeitgeist again, so I'm going to loop back to that before we start. But we've got a tweet of the week with some, I think the technical term is just some wild-ass conspiracy stuff. But we're tying that back to narrative ideas. I've got a cultish corner. We're going to talk about a friend of the show, Tom Morgan, and his Sohn presentation, which was not on a stock tip, but was on a philosophy, which I love so dearly. And like I said, let's big story in zeitgeist. We're kicking this off straight away on this. The through line here is follow the money. But specifically, the place we're going to start is with, let's start with Gaza and Israel and some of the stuff that's going on before we get into the US elections. So Ben, I want to point this to you first. You've had a couple tweets about this, and maybe we even start with the Biden administration and this little incident that we had with some missiles. Help us think about why we're following the money here, and then let's dive into some of these headlines.
So, you know, it's interesting, Matt. I think that the backdrop is around, on a domestic front, I think is around, we'll call it $10 phrase, you know, nominal growth, meaning number go up going into the election. Totally get that. And then also the backdrop is Biden's got to run the table with Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. That's the path to getting reelected. If he loses any one of those three states, I think it's very difficult, at least with the current dynamics you've got in the election this year. Right. And so that's difficult, and it's linked to Israel and Gaza, and the Middle East more broadly, because Michigan, Wisconsin both have a large Arab American population that skews traditionally heavily Democratic, but is very, very, let's say, unhappy with the direction, the perceived, and I think real pro-Israel approach that this administration has had. So the Biden administration is between an enormous rock and a hard place with however they support or don't support Israel. It's just a really hard spot.
And when we think about this, and I'm using follow the money in great big giant air quotes here, but the idea is we have an election fast approaching. We've narrowed down on who these swing states and where voter turnout is going to matter the most. And it's what do we need to do with the stories that are in the zeitgeist to get the right people to turn out for the right, and I use the word right side, meaning like the Biden administration side, the Trump side, whatever party you want to look at here.
Yeah.
This is about turnout and what are the resonant stories and resonant presentations of the story to get that turnout. Do I have that right?
You've got it right. And let's focus first of all on, I think, the most important part, which this is about turnout. This is not about, oh, I voted for Biden, you know, 3.5 years ago, and I'm going to switch my vote to Trump. There's nobody who's doing that. Of course, there are some people who are doing that, but there are too few people for that to matter. And I'm sure there are equally too few to matter in the other direction. What national elections are all about, this will be no exception, is turnout. Can you get more of your people showing up to cast a vote than the other guy or gal can get his or her people to show up that day. That's the Biden issue, right? It's not that, and this is why I think that the comeback saying, yeah, he's a flawed candidate, but, you know, there is no alternative. Well, there is an alternative. The alternative is you stay home. That's the alternative. So it's not that these are people who are going to switch their votes. These are people who are going to stay home and not vote at all. And in a tight race like these are going to be very tight, that's how you lose. That's how you lose.
It's crazy to think that like the third space in election language is not turn left, turn right, not stay center. Like the third space here is just don't show up at the polls. This is not Starbucks. This is not a good thing for a true popular election if just stay home is a viable option. And we know it historically has been, I guess.
Yeah. And look, particularly with a system like the United States, which is what we call first past the post, right? It's structurally a two-party system and essentially impossible for third parties to survive for long here in the United States. It means that so long as you get just more votes than the other party, you win, right? So it's never been about getting the most people to vote. It's always about getting one more vote than the other side's getting. It's an important difference in the kind of candidates that get nominated for positions and the way that the system works through and through. It's not about, you know, maximizing the number of people you get voting for you. It's getting one more than the other guy.
So does this focus on turnout, does this change the whole idea of you typically move to the center for the general election? Because if I want turnout, do I want to appeal to my extreme people more and get them to come out and I don't care as much about the center? I mean, does this change that whole adage that you move to the center for the general election?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely does. Absolutely does. And you've totally seen that, over the last 16 years, you've totally seen that. That's why they always talk about energizing the base. And look, right now, there's no question that the Republicans have got a more energized base than the Democrats. The one, you know, domestic issue on which that is different is abortion, right? So right now, you've got an energized Democratic base on that topic. It's flipping, you know, that's what happens when something becomes status quo, right? Roe v. Wade was status quo, so the insurgent had more energy, that being the other side, the Republican side here. Now that Roe v. Wade's out and it's up to the states, it's returned to the states, the energy is with the Democratic side. Is it, whoever is the insurgent always has more energy. That's just the way these things work, because it's easier to complain or say you do something different than to maintain a status quo. And what the Republican Party has done, and the old Republican Party did as well, is they pulled themselves as, we are the status quo. So this will get into a lot more of our conversations today, but everything that picks at the status quo, that's going to have more energy. And that's, you know, like it or not, and I don't, this was Trump's, I don't want to call it brilliance or what it's lucked into, but that's what he did. He reformed the Republican Party from the inside, as opposed to having a third party movement or something like that, that co-opted it from the outside. So it's, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, which also explains, by the way, why Yellen is over in China and, you know, talking about U.S. industrial policy good, Chinese industrial policy bad, because they've got to do something about Chinese exports of, particularly of EVs, electric vehicles, because they've got to win Detroit. They've got to win Detroit. So they're going to be really hard on China, particularly on cars. You know, Trump's already saying he's going to put his 100% tariffs on Chinese cars. So they're all pushing as hard as they can on Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania.
I was just looking at your tweet on this, and like this idea of reforming the Republican Party has also changed what the swing states are, right? I mean, Michigan and Wisconsin were not traditional swing states. Those were Democratic. Those were pretty guaranteed Democratic states, right? So we're kind of looking at a different road, like a different map. Or am I wrong about that in terms of what the swing states are?
Well, 2016, Trump won because he won those states, right? So it's, Biden won them in 2020.
But before Trump, Democrats would pretty much win those states, right?
Well, no. So back, I'm old enough to remember George Wallace. So George Wallace was the Democratic governor of Alabama. Segregation now, segregation forever. Standing in the steps of the university to keep black students from attending. George Wallace was the segregationist governor of Alabama, and he ran for president in 72. Yeah, 72. He won Michigan, and he was polling really well a lot of other places, particularly in the North. So he won the Michigan primary, and he was, it's crazy to think of it now, right? But A, George Wallace was a Democrat, not a Republican, and B, George Wallace won the Democratic primary. Now, he got shot and paralyzed and got knocked out of the race, but if that hadn't happened, So, long way of saying that I'll call the blue-collar work demographic of Michigan is not just what we now think of as the Democratic Party. It's not a slam dunk.
And as we think, it's fair to say that Trump, things are looking in Trump's favor right now in terms of how the swing states are playing out, right? At least where we are today.
Yeah. Latest polls. And this is what the Democrats say, and they're right. It's a long time between now and November, long time, but Trump is polling way ahead of where he polled in these states, these swing states, in 2016 or 2020. So it's an uphill climb. And so look, this gets me back to the money, which is that everyone in Washington, I mean, pretty much everyone on Wall Street as well, is in the bag for, what I'm calling nominal growth. Nominal growth means just number go up. It doesn't matter whether it's because of inflation. It doesn't matter because it's real, i.e. non-inflationary. Everyone's in the bag for the number going up between now and November. And that's why, it seems crazy to think that the Fed could cut where, prices are where inflation is, but I bet they cut. I absolutely bet they cut. It's number go up. And then the belief is in Washington, well, we'll deal with it after November. On Wall Street, it's, hey, I got to get mine now, Jack, before November, because everybody's looking at November and what comes afterwards and saying there is going to be, again, to use one of your technical terms, Matt, a shitstorm.
It's like in the Wall Street thing, it's like, this is where we know the chaos happens is after November. We can't predict what's going on there. And we can only predict the next however many months. We're really looking at this and going, great. So just how do we front load all the returns into now and then wait for the shitstorm to sort it all out for us?
So why Wall Street always is.
Right.
I get it. I totally get it. I'll use a crypto phrase. Everybody's pumping their bags right now, without exception. Everyone right now, you've got 6 months, 7 months to pump your bags.
And do you think...
That's it, man. That's what's happening.
How about the Fed? Some people will say, well, the Fed's independent. They don't care about this at all. Like, I mean, do you think they're doing this as well? I mean, do you think they have, they're being pressured, they have an incentive to try to do this, you know, leading into the election?
Of course they are. It's not because they necessarily favor the Democrat side, although I think they do. I absolutely think they do. They favor the status quo. Yeah, I mean, I can't put it any simpler than that. I mean, is Jay Powell, what's his political stance? He's a Republican. He's a Republican. But he's not a Donald Trump Republican. My view is, actually, Jay Powell is a conservative in the true sense of the word, a small c conservative. There ain't nothing conservative about MAGA or what the Republican Party has become. It's a joke to say that that's conservatism. It's an absolute joke. It's just false. So conservatism means I want to keep things pretty much the same. The Fed exists to serve the interest of capital with a capital C. They are there to make sure the banks do well and are healthy. That's their job. That's why they were created. And for that, its number go up and try not to elect somebody who could blow it all up.
So in that sense, from the Fed's perspective too, almost much like Wall Street, the better we can have GDP go up, inflation go down, and keep jobs in a healthy place, that's the most successful status game for the Fed to play at this point as well too.
It is, but if you have to give up on something, mm-hmm. you give up on anything except the number go up part.
Right. You can almost turn a blind eye to all the other things and just say, we have to just keep this number tracking in this way, because then that's success by the Fed mandate.
Yes.
And we can say we're not political or whatever else, so long as we made the number go up, or tell everybody we made the number go up.
Stock market up, and the reported GDP numbers and growth numbers up. So that's what we're going to get.
It's interesting. I don't know if you may not agree with this, but I was talking to Andy Constant on a separate podcast recently, mm-hmm. and there is at least, in terms of that number go up thing, there is at least a trade-off that exists now, which didn't for every other election, in that there is inflation now, and inflation at least does have some political consequences if it goes up. I mean, I guess it wouldn't go up until after the election, so it would be an issue for somebody else. But we've lived in a world for a long time where you could do number go up and you don't have to worry about anything because there was no inflation. And now there at least are some legitimate trade-offs going on.
Yeah. And what I'm saying is that the trade-offs don't matter for the next 7 months. I mean, it is existential time, and it's an opportunity to make a lot of money. So, future will take care of itself, and next 6 months, going to make a lot of money.
And that's because basically the inflation wouldn't become an issue till later. It would be after November. So even if inflation is a bad issue for them, it's not going to manifest itself right now. It's going to be more in the future.
It's worse than that, Jack. I mean, inflation can be now, but it will be, you'll describe it. And we've had plenty of conversations, the three of us, about the different ways of looking at inflation, different ways of measuring inflation. We will continue to find ways of describing the economy so as to say, don't worry about inflation. That's what we'll continue to find all the way through November. And then after November, depending on who gets elected, that story about whether inflation is here and a problem will change. Right? It has nothing to do with the reality because the reality in the decision making of households and corporations is that inflation is embedded. It's embedded in wages. It's embedded in labor. It's embedded in prices. And once it's there, it doesn't just go away. It just builds. It'll wax and wane a little bit from month to month. At some point here, we'll get a month that is actually cooler on inflation than expected. I don't know when. Maybe next month. Maybe the month after that. Maybe the month after that. I don't know. But just by luck, by variance, we will have that month. And everybody will say, oh my God, inflation is not a problem. And then the Fed cuts. I'm not predicting, I'm observing. as George Soros likes to say. By the way, I like Andy Constant a lot. He's fantastic. Like him a ton. Like the way he thinks about all of this, including how do you position yourself for that. But it's distressing. It's distressing.
So sure. Is it fair to say in this environment right now, whether we're talking about Israel or we're talking about inflation, that it's basically now till November, it's how to just take and reframe that story in the way that supports both number go up and voter turnout. And that's kind of the only thing that anybody's talking about.
Yes.
And therefore, yes. That's the only thing anybody's really gunning for or aiming for. So even when a media outlet reports a story in a certain way, each candidate's army of people is going to descend upon the story and immediately reframe it to serve one of those two goals?
Well, for sure. I think the challenge is even more difficult if you are an Israeli policymaker, right? Or a Chinese policymaker.
Yeah, because if we're steering everything through this funnel, there's ripple right. effects to the loudest voices in the world kind right. of trying to present right. everything in the way that we present it.
So what you've got to think about is, you know, you want to hedge your bets because the election is going to be close. It's going to be close, right? The election's not, if it was held tomorrow, right? Trump wins. The election's not going to be held tomorrow. I think that I haven't seen anything from the Biden administration, the Biden political staff here that makes me think that they're competent enough to win this election. So I'm increasingly very depressed because it increasingly looks to me like Trump wins. But it's a long time, a lot can happen, blah, blah, blah. That's all true. What I'm saying is that for the next 6 months, everything that happens domestically gets focused through those lenses. And so if you're non-domestic, if you're a foreign decision maker, you've got to think, well, I'm an Israeli cabinet member. I think I'm in an existential war with Hamas. What I also know is that everything we do is going to get filtered through that lens with my indispensable ally, the United States. It makes it really hard. It really does.
Does it change like the way Israel is waging that war? I mean, because they're getting more pushback than they were in terms of how they're doing it. I mean, when we talked about the total war thing, it was kind of like, we don't care about the narrative. We're just going to, you know, we're going to do what we got to do. But they do need the United States to some degree, right? So, I mean, does it change how they actually, you know, wage the war?
I don't know. I kind of think not. I think their calculus, this would be my calculus if I'm in their shoes, is that, yes, the United States is my indispensable ally. By the same token, we, Israel, are indispensable to the United States. So I don't, you know, neither political party can afford a break with Israel. The problem for Biden is he can't afford not to break either. It's a terrible spot he's in. It's a terrible spot that Biden's in. And it gives a lot of leverage to Israel. Let's be clear. Ton of leverage to Israel. Because at the same token that Biden's getting killed in Michigan and Wisconsin over supporting Israel, if he wants to have a chance in a lot of other states, and I think being perceived as being anti-Israel and not supportive enough for Israel, man, that's a tough road to hoe as well, right? In American politics. In other words, Jack, it's got to be about turnout. You got to get turnout from people who are mobilized for you. But whichever way he goes, he's going to lose enthusiasm, let's say it, or even grudging willingness to show up and vote from a large group of his base. And that's a real problem.
Just a real problem.
So you, when we talked about Israel the first time, you were somewhat worried about escalation. And I know recently, like Israel, there was an incident in Lebanon, I believe, where they killed an Iranian general, or at least people think they did it. Iran said they're going to retaliate in the strongest way possible, or whatever their words were. I'm just, what do you think about like the potential for escalation there? And, you know, maybe we can talk about it too through the lens of the election as well.
Yeah, I think, I think escalation can always happen. I don't get a real kind of tingly, spidey sense about it, honestly, Jack. Yeah, because I'm thinking if I'm Iran, you know, do I really want to give an opportunity to kind of take this pressure off of Joe Biden? Because doing something militarily against Israel would take the pressure off of Biden. Right. I mean, it would just kind of cement the United States here. I think Iran's playing kind of just the waiting game. It's kind of working in their favor right now, right? It's the degree of infighting and what's the right way to say it? The degree of polarization and weakening of the United States from the inside is phenomenal right now. If you think, okay, there's a point in November where everything changes, if you're Iran, why would you want to mess that up? I mean, why in the world would you mess that up? You're Putin, right? Why do you want to mess that up? I mean, it's working as better than you could possibly have imagined. It's impossible that your actions could create this kind of internal dissension in the United States. We're doing it to ourselves. So why would you, it's the old rule, right? If somebody's digging a hole, you don't need to help them. You just let them dig.
Well, speaking of digging holes, let's go to our favorite hole, perhaps the blackest of all holes, Twitter, for our tweet of the week. We're talking about conspiracy theories, and I think this actually feeds exactly into this point. This feeds into the premise here of these holes we dig that keep tunneling us further and further apart. And yeah, why get in the way and maybe even pass a shovel down the hole to your good friends? Jack, you want to share this tweet with us?
Yeah, I have so many questions about this one, Ben. But so we'll start at the beginning here, though. Cat Turd, not just Cat Turd, but Cat Turd TM is the tweeter of the original thing here.
The trademark's important. Very important.
Yeah, the trademark is definitely important. Distinguished himself from standard Cat Turd, I guess. Or yeah. I mean, I guess he owns the
no,
rights.
No, it's the old guy. Yeah, he's same guy.
But anyway, every damn morning when the skies are perfectly blue, dozens of planes start crisscrossing my skyline in the middle of nowhere in an exact tic-tac-toe pattern, which expands and makes it overcast in about 20 minutes. I've lived in this area for decades, and it just started happening lately. I see this with my own eyes, and I'm not dumb. So, and then you responded to this with, you retweeted this and said, my best guess is that 20% of Americans believe that the government is seeding the atmosphere with nefarious chemicals, and I'm probably too low.
Yeah.
So I have so many questions, Ben, but I mean, how did we get to, like, what is your general reaction to this? And how did we get to that point? I mean, I would have guessed way lower than 20% of people
think. No, it's
higher. So I'm obviously out of touch a little bit with this.
Yeah, no, I was talking to my, you know, partner, Rusty, had been down in Texas visiting family and the like. He said, you know, you have no idea in my circles how many people think that, you know, the government has the program through chemtrails to, you know, there are different variations on this theme. Are we poisoning the atmosphere? Are we, doing something kind of in the same way you put microchips into vaccines for mind control, right? Is it a mind control thing? Is it a poisoning thing? It's opinions vary, you know, on what the purpose is. But, oh my God, once you start going down this rabbit hole, and it's the whole Q adjacent MAGA pretty centric view that there are all these programs that are there to trying to control the weather. And look, I understand what cloud seeding is. I get it, right? And I understand people talking about, oh, well, you know, let's do something with the atmosphere to prevent global warming. By the way, do you know the biggest reason why ocean temperatures in the North Atlantic have gone up so much? Right? It's because we've actually reduced pollution. The sulfur, I think it's sulfur dioxide, something like that, in the bunker fuel, the fuel you use for tankers and ships. Right? It's so much cleaner now that that's not going up into the atmosphere. And so it's a real problem. We've reduced pollution in the atmosphere, and that actually is now exacerbating global warming. So, point being, it's much more than 20%. I now think it's like 30% of the country seriously believes that chemtrails are part of a plot to, like, say, control the weather, control us, do whatever, you know, the satanic overlords are doing, which kind of gets us into the next rabbit hole, I think, that I went into, which is around CERN, you know, the super collider guys in Switzerland, and it's just that they're opening up a portal to hell, and that this is what's going to unleash the devil on Earth. And it's just mind-boggling to me how many people are both versed in and perfectly happy to believe all of this, all of it.
I when I see stuff like this, I always tend to believe it's getting worse, but then I realize maybe I just don't understand it that well. Like, is this something like 10 years, 20 years ago would have been like this? Or is this something the internet has made a lot worse?
Yeah, it's made it a lot worse. It's made it a lot worse. And what's really made it a lot worse has been the, you know, horrific, you know, public health response by the status quo, by our institutions, who have absolutely lied to us because it's a noble lie, because they believe you can't handle the truth. So when this stuff gets revealed, and it always does, it's always the cover-up that gets you, then anything becomes possible. Any crazy-ass idea becomes possible. And it's and used by those who would use these sort of language, right, intentionally for their own benefit. Okay. Because a lot of these conspiracy theories have been true, right? And so now everything becomes, well, it's possible.
These adjacent issues too, and even the whole, like, this is an old sideline fascination of mine from years ago with, like, the whole skeptic movement and everything else before, like, all things that I love eventually seem to devolve into some weird QAnon adjacent thing. In fact, really wonderful memories of being, you know, a 90s kid and, like, anarchist bookstores and all this stuff. And we could sit around and talk about the JFK assassination, and not that it doesn't matter, but we could sit around and talk about it and it didn't matter.
And it didn't matter. Right. And
now it matters. And that's a hard thing to process. Cause like there was a point in time where we just walk away from this, and my friends and I just gravitate away from listening to Art Bell on the radio or whatever the UFO show.
Right.
Like, it was good friggin' fun. It was good fun. But now chemtrails and contrails and, like, understanding this, it's like, no, these are two different words, and there's science now this happens, but we want to believe this thing. Like, there's not a fun element anymore. It's a very serious element. And it also feels like this is being, like, we're being wound up to talk about this stuff. Do you want to connect that back?
Those things are so true, Matt, right? So we're wound up to talk about it. That's engagement. And it becomes absolutely mainstream for political candidates. I mean, the stuff that RFK Jr. says, right? I mean, it's just... Oh man, sorry, you're getting me all down.
Well, no, but
your points are so well put, Matt. That it's being mainstreamed for a reason, a political reason and an economic reason. The economic reason is engagement, and the political reason is active base turnout.
That piece, the engagement matters more than anything because active turnout matters more than anything. And therefore, it doesn't matter by which means we get you there. It doesn't matter if that's in the comments about some whatever the planes are dropping on you to control your mind. Reduces down to that.
It's just shocking to me. I know I'm kind of coming from the outside, like not understanding this stuff that well, but like, you don't, if you believe this, do you go through in your own mind and like figure out like, all right, they're flying planes in a crisscross pattern over my head. Like why are they doing that? Like, what are they trying to accomplish with that? Like, do you take it? I mean, I know these things kind of break down when you start taking them down to that level, but like for the people who believe this, do they do that? I mean, are they thinking about like, what would be the motivation? Why would the government be doing this? Like, how do you actually get like all these planes to do that? Like, it seems very unrealistic that would actually be happening. I mean, I don't know if they think there are military planes that are doing this. It seems like it all breaks down. I'm just wondering like how much that logic and stuff plays into people who think this way.
I'm always, you know, wary to say, you know, people who think this way, because because I made fun of, you know, cat turd saying, and I'm not dumb. But the fact is he's not dumb. He's not dumb. It's hard to distinguish between the Alex Joneses of the world, right, who are also not dumb, but are using all of this just very instrumentally and as sociopaths. I think there has been a normalization of sociopathy to the point where people expect our government and all institutions to have a sociopathic attitude towards them. And sadly, they're not, they're often very right about that. And so I feel like it's not a matter of being dumb at all. I think it is absolutely a matter of all trust in any institution has been frittered away for money, for I got mine now, Jack. And I just don't know there's anything coming back from this. It's not really a matter, I don't think, Jack, of logic or, oh, you're dumb or you're not being logical about this, even though I agree with you entirely. I mean, there is no grand conspiracy. There's just not. It would be impossible to maintain that. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's not a matter of logic or being smart. It's a matter of recognizing that, yeah, I don't trust anything you say. And if you don't trust anything, if there's no trust, then there is no relationship. There is no connection.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is kind of a separate thing from this, but it's just in terms of like reading this stuff and believing this stuff. Like when I used to live down in Georgia, and I lived in a pretty, you know, I'm a pretty centrist guy, but I lived in a pretty right wing side of Georgia. And I remember like when we were just having dinner with a couple, and just having like normal conversations. And then they just brought up this story about, you know, Joe Biden and his involvement with Jeffrey Epstein and like all this stuff that just was not, I mean, none of it, if you fact check it, would be logically true.
Right.
But it was clearly 100% reality. And maybe that's the way this is being put to us. You know, that's just the world we're in. And again, it's not about being dumb, but it is interesting that like these things that, and that's a totally different thing than this, but these things that are, you know, not factually correct are getting put into our minds and they're leading to our actions. And it's just a bad spiral, it seems like to me.
It is a bad spiral, and there's no coming back from it. I mean that. There's no coming back from it. There's no coming back to say, Donald Trump was a legit friend of Jeff Epstein's, right? I mean, not just, we met, right? But like they hung out. Legit friends. It's an impossible situation. There's no coming back from it. And one last thing, because your friends who are saying this, they're not dumb.
Right? No, definitely not.
Right? They're not dumb people. They're not dumb people. And so it's so far beyond that. It's at the point where people don't believe anything that people say to them. So there's nothing you can say to them, a fact that is more or less believable than the most bald-faced lie.
I'm going to encourage David McCraney's work on this, Michael Shermer's work on this. There's a whole bunch of people out there, if you're interested in this, send us a message, send us an email, leave a comment. Happy to point you at some of this stuff, but it's so important because it's the underpinning of trust and not just blind trust, which I think this is a perfect segue taking you guys to the cultish corner. We're talking about our friend Tom Morgan. Tom got on stage at the Sohn conference, which Ben or Jack, one of you, when you think of the Sohn conference, what do you think of normally?
Yeah, it's a famous investor conference. And particularly value investors, where you want to really dive into a particular company. So famously, the Sohn conference invites people to come in and to give a talk about an investment thesis, a company, a group of companies that you've done a deep dive into, and you're going to tell them why you're really bullish on it or why you're really bearish on it.
And we get fantastic examples of this. There's lots through history. There's some great historic presentations from this conference that are worth digging out. There's some great exposés that happen live on the stage. Mm-hmm. But our friend Tom Morgan gets a 5-minute slot, and bless Tom's heart. Tom shows up and he doesn't pitch a stock. He literally pitches a philosophy. And most importantly, I think, and most profoundly to me watching this thing, is Tom is preaching curiosity to us. And that's kind of the missing element in everything we're talking about here. He's citing Dr. Ian McGilchrist. There's a bunch of very thick books that, if you're so inclined and inspired, I highly recommend, but they are dense, but you will leave them feeling profound. McGilchrist says, the right hemisphere is responsible for, in every case, the more important part of our ability to come to an understanding of the world. Now, quick primer for those of you, when you think of slicing up the brain and all the little things, and you say, wasn't that disproved like hundreds of years ago? And yes, it was mostly disproved as glorified conspiracy theories of their time, but there's still some stuff we actually do know about the right and left hemisphere that's valid, that has neuroscience behind it, and is important in this context. Because what Dr. Ian McGilchrist and our friend Tom Morgan is saying is that the left side of our brain is the logical, so think math and spreadsheets and provable points, definitively provable points. And then on the right side, we have the intuition. We have the math or the magic. We have the myths. We have our gut reactions that live on the right side of the brain. We have experiments where we can more or less shut off either side in various ways and see this manifest in when one is absent from the other. And Dr. McGilchrist's points are that the world is getting very left. We're getting very, very logical. We're getting very, very oriented around these provable points, which comes back to these conspiracy theories, which comes back to all these ideas, things that feel very compelling and very proven for sake of engagement. Tom's presentation, he starts saying, this is where a lot of these things start to evolve from that we're perceiving as crises. This is where a lot of the problems show up. And I want to take both of you back with me on this piece. I started to say it before, but now I'm thinking of it even more. I'm thinking about, so again, 90s kid, anarchist bookstores. We're thinking of this stuff. There's a great song, and I believe it becomes called Down at the State House by this band called The Slackers. Vic Ruggiero wrote it, and it first shows up on a Rancid album in like the middle of the 90s. And it's basically the premise of this song is Vic and his friends going, yeah, we hang out in New York City and we talk about conspiracy theories and wild ass stuff with each other. But then you get in a van with your friends and you start to travel and you go like, oh, there's a Confederate flag at this state house down here. What's going on with this? And people give you answers and they sound logical. They sound smart. And you start to learn about history the more you learn about traveling and the more you start asking questions. And stuff gets taken away from you. The anarchist bookstore turns into some QAnon adjacent wildness. And you go like, those aren't my people anymore. They took the fun out of it. But then other stuff starts to happen. Like we start to go, wait, why is this Confederate flag being flown at this state house? Why is this stuff here? This balancing act is the balancing between left and right. This is the thing about what's truly a provable point, but what's curious enough to make us ask that one more question. Jack, I know this resonates with you in some ways as a factor and quant investor type. Yeah. You love the provable point, but you also love the randomness that the markets throw at you every day. Like, see your world through this lens for me for a second.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking when you were saying that, like going back to the questions I was just asking Ben, like you can tell I am Mr. Left Side of the Brain guy, like, and I'm not understanding, like, I think I run into that problem in life in general, not just in investing, like this idea that I have to like logically put everything through this logical filter. And, you know, and sometimes in relationships and everything in the markets, like that's not necessarily the way you want to do it. You don't want to be like, oh, this person's going through this certain situation. Well, logically, let me tell you exactly the way you should think about that. Like that's not the right, that's certainly not the way to go about it. So like, I really enjoyed Tom's presentation from that perspective. Like it's something I need to work on. It's something I can learn from, I think.
But as a factor investor, you also like, I've watched you do this with Validian. I see the work you do. There's limitations to like the math always. There's always a reality you have to map this back against. And you can never lose the curiosity and the reality of what you're trying to map.
Yeah, well, you can run down a rabbit hole and get yourself in trouble with math. You know, math can tell you a lot of things about the past and about factors and about a lot of that stuff that's not going to hold true in the future. So, you know, you have to, there's definitely a curiosity and like a creativity and a way to think through these things that you have to do when you build these types of strategies. And, you know, people like me who build these strategies are not built that way. You know, we're not built that way, but, you know, from like thinking about the way Ben is thinks about the markets with narrative and stuff like that. I mean, that's something that if you build factor strategies like I do with math all day and you look at history and stuff, you know, you're going to miss that kind of stuff. You know, if the markets are more driven by narrative and they're not driven by fundamentals, and I'm sitting here running a bunch of fundamentals through my historical tests and I'm not considering anything else in the world and I'm not, you know, using any creativity or anything like that, I'm going to get myself into some trouble. So it's an example of where you have to be able to balance this stuff. And it's something where earlier in my career, I was not as good at it. And maybe now I'm getting at least a little bit better, hopefully.
What about you, Ben? Like, where do you, this curiosity bridge, because you straddle these worlds too.
Yeah, this is why I called my writing Epsilon Theory, right? So Epsilon is the error term on every econometric formula, including the one that Jack knows really well. So do you, Matt, the core of portfolio analysis, which is your portfolio performance is a combination of alpha, the idiosyncratic edge that you have, beta, the way you go up or down with the overall market, and that's it. Everything else, there's a little plus E, there's a little epsilon symbol that people typically ignore, right? Because it's just error. It's the error term. It's not error. It's everything that's not captured by the left hemisphere of your brain. It's everything that's not being captured by the factors that you've identified that go into either the alpha or the beta bucket. It's not error. It's epsilon. And it includes, my thinking, everything that's worthwhile about humans, in particular, our social interaction. So it's not game theory, it's epsilon theory, because epsilon, it's not error, it's not a mistake, it's actually where all the magic is.
Parker Palmer, one of my favorite writer and philosophers, he has this term he calls the tragic gap. And he defines the tragic gap as the space between the world that we know is possible and the world as it is. And he warns us about that if we leave the gap and we just go to the world that's possible, we risk falling into irrelevant idealism. And I've described this, I'm just referencing this post for my own memory on this one. It's like, we'll be putting pictures on Instagram of the wall hanging platitudes that your sort of friend's parents bought at Target, or worse, we become starving artists who believe there's no such thing as anybody who cares about what we do, and then why we waste away quietly in isolated, frustrated irrelevance, because we have this irrelevant idealism for a world that we believe is possible, that we can't will into existence. And if we leave the gap and move to the world as it is, Parker calls that corrosive cynicism. And I commented, we'll be so sure wasting time on creating anything that doesn't produce a buck is worthless, so that all we do is chase bucks with spreadsheets in hand, dominating our schedules, our lives, and we never have time for the sheer joy of bullshit. The tragic gap, that's somewhere in between the ability to dream it and do it. And that's the epsilon. That's, it's not the error term. It's actually the bridge of what we're standing over to go, oh, I see both shores from here. I see like the stories as different people say them with nuance, but I understand that I have to be able to double back. I have to be able to cross this bridge.
Yep.
Ben, how do you think about crossing the bridge back and forth and like taking what you need back to the middle?
It's not easy. And it's made more difficult when you've got a system, and we actually have a system that's been built to maximize, right? This was Tom's point that we live in a market and a politics that is technically sociopathic, meaning it's all left hemisphere of the brain. It is for maximization, not for humanization. And the trick, I think, is that we've gone so far in the structure of our lives towards maximization and distance and clinical sociopathy that the challenge is not as much going back and forth as the challenge is in escaping that and embracing what we've lost in terms of our human connection and relationships. So I think that was Tom's big point, and it's certainly my big point as well in everything I do.
Kind of like getting on stage at an investment conference and pitching right a philosophy.
On. Exactly.
Poetic in all the ways. Gentlemen, I think I have a summary for us today.
Bring it home, Matt.
Let's try to bring this home. So we started off talking about how national elections are always about turnout. They're about who shows up, and that means who's charged up. So the just stay at home non-voters are as important in total strategy as the voters, which is a profound thing to keep in mind as you walk these campaign ads. Side note, having moved from Connecticut to Pennsylvania and straddled some of this in the last election, man, if you go to different places and just watch the TV ads, you will have a very unique experience of what different people around the country are seeing in this with regard to charging people up. You win because you just get one more vote than the other guy. So, Jack, you made the point. This is why you don't tilt center anymore. And Ben, you made the point that this is about energizing the base, because if insurgents have the energy, the whole game becomes let's get insurgent. We talked about how the Fed serves capital C capital, meaning banks and Wall Street. Number go up. There's no other trade-offs that matter. Ben, you said it's existential time coming up in November, and that means it's probably exponential return time for now. The problems really are post-November, and I made the note to myself. This is extra Wyclef here, meaning Wyclef the singer from the Fugees and his Carnival album. Inflation, problems, they're all gone till November at this point. And policymakers globally, US, the US, us, the indispensable ally here, is that means nuance probably is also gone till November on this. We talked about conspiracy theories. We talked about the plots of the chemtrails versus the contrails, the CERN dancers, if you will, the cover-ups that basically tell you there's a reveal coming. I'm thinking about that movie about the reveal and how that's really the whole magic trick is in the moment leading up to that. And so we're wound up to talk about this stuff, even if it doesn't matter. Because even if the idea doesn't matter, if it's just the debate in the back of the anarchist bookstore, what matters is the engagement. What matters is the voter turnout. What matters is that you build the entire story and priority around engagement and turnout and these things. We're all being steered by that stuff. That's the corrosive cynicism. That's the narcissism that we see. That's the absolutely cynical approach we get to our media and everything else because we can't laugh about it. And most importantly, back to Tom Morgan, we can't be curious about it because this left-leaning logic and the right-leaning intuition in our brains, not our political parties, at least not exactly, we can't not have both. Excuse me, all my English teachers in my family. We can't not have both of those things. Curiosity becomes this bridge. And most importantly, the bridge has to be not the error term. The bridge has to be, it's not something that's wrong with us. That's why we call it the epsilon. The fun is in the bridge. The smile is in the bridge. The bridge might even look like a smile. Think of it that way. It's kind of beautiful. We should be able to stand in the middle and wink at both sides because they're the things that are holding us up. The error term is the thing that actually holds it up, that allows the bridge to stand in between irrelevant idealism and corrosive cynicism without falling into either one of those banks. So the world we know is possible, the world where we know it is, as it is. And we got to put our feet on this and we got to stand in the middle. Epsilon Theory, that's the Breaking News Podcast. This is what we're trying to do. Stand here in the middle, have these conversations, acknowledge the shores around us. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Matt. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to like and subscribe wherever you're watching Breaking News so more people can find our show. If you know another clear-eyed and full-hearted individual, why not share this episode with them too? Like we said at the top, the media is making us tick, and it's our job to talk. Follow the headlines at fiatnews.com. Follow Ben at epsilontheory.com and at epsilontheory on Twitter. Follow Jack at validiacapital.com and at practicalquant on Twitter. Follow Matt at sunpointinvestments.com, cultishcreative.com, and at cultishcreative on Twitter.